is with great pleasure we welcome back Donald Preziosi for part two of his lecture on art, religion, and amnesia. And although Donald wants me to keep this brief, I thought I'd mention a few things about this distinguished scholar and remarkable professor. What stands out when considering Donald is that he began a rather early study of the classics at the tender age of seven under the tutelage of his father by reading out loud in archaic Latin the 12 books of the Aeneid. As an undergraduate, Donald received his BA in the classics of Greek and Latin literature, and also in English literature. He went on to Harvard to receive both his MA in linguistics and his PhD in art history and archaeology. While he completed his PhD, he lived in Greece for 3 years. He has gone on to study critical theory. Donald has written 12 books on art and cultural history, theory and criticism, and the most recent books, which are Brain of the Earth's Body, which we have in the bookstore, Art Museums and Phantasms of Modernity, Grasping the World, the Idea of the Museum, In the Aftermath of Art, Ethics, Aesthetics, and Politics. He is currently working on a book on art, religion, and politics, which is the subject of today's talk. The book is entitled Enchanted Credulities, Art, Religion, and Amnesia. He has taught at Yale University, MIT, UCLA, and more recently at Oxford University, the University of Colorado, and fortunately for all of us, at Naropa University. In the past year, Donald has traveled and lectured in Europe, England, Scandinavia, and in China, and very shortly he will be leaving for Australia. In considering how to introduce Donald, I asked Eleni Sikelionis how she would describe Donald's gifts. And the first thing that came into her mind was that the embroidery lies on the inside. So this might mean at times, in order to catch a bit of the fabric, the stitching of light, the quicksilver run of this man's mind, one might consider slowing down, leaning in, and listening a bit closer. Donald is certain to present us with curious and difficult things to consider.
Down slightly to see the images because they're essential to really turn things in here. Thank you, Susan, for that interesting bit of fiction. Right, it's a very good degree in fiction from her. I apologize slightly for my voice, which became enchanted on its own on the trip to England about 10 days ago or so. But it's about to land, it's almost here, it's almost back. So one of the reasons we're copying this paper so you can have it in front of you, which help you in case my voice was not with you. You always have a certain sense of text. So what you're going to hear is very, very experimental. It's part of a work in progress, a book on the problem of art and religion. And my talk today is really going to be about terrorism. We seem to be terrorized with recently. And the danger of art with respect to religion and truth. As with any activity which impacts upon and affects the perception of others, artistry is of any kind is therefore a profoundly political and ethical activity, whether or not explicitly acknowledged or intended. My talk is called Art, Religion, and Amnesia. It's aimed at those concerned about the missions, effects, and promises of art at the present time, and what that might entail for our practices as artists, critics, historians, writers, fabricators of all kinds. It's also aimed at those who may be concerned with art's promise with respect to what in modern times is referred to commonly as religion, a word with a curious history. Having been adopted by early Christianity from Roman law, originally referring to the social and cultural customs and practices that legally bind communities together, or ligatures related to religion. The term came into its own theologically when, in order to ensure the unswerving loyalty of his army, the politically astute Roman Emperor Constantine declared a hitherto largely underground cult popular mostly with Roman soldiers, Christianity, as the official imperial state religion in the 4th century, making its practice legally binding to all Roman citizens. Believe or be socially, legally, politically, or economically ostracized or worse. My talk is designed as a series of deliberate provocations regarding issues which I believe to be fundamental to much of how we conceive of what we do as artists today, and how we may be also unwittingly or wittingly amnesiac with respect to the implications of artistic practices for civil society in the contemporary world. On one level, it deals with the relations between two practices nominally distinct in modern life, namely art and religion, but which I will argue are different and obversely equivalent perspectives on fundamental problems of life and existence. I'll not be arguing for what has sometimes loosely been termed the spiritual dimension or essence of artistry, nor will I be arguing for its converse, the aesthetic dimension or essence of religiosities or spiritualities. Art is, of course, as much a religious practice as religion is an aesthetic one, although there's a good deal that's been useful and important about such writing in recent years. I think it's time to try moving what had become a rather stale discourse and debate about the relations between art and spirituality to a different and, hope, more fundamental and potentially more effective arena of discussion. There are and have been in many societies different traditional entry points into these difficult problems, which are of very great antiquity in the West. But what I'd like to do here is to try to articulate one point of entry which is rarely directly confronted and about which there's enormous amount of confusion. This entry point is concerned with the problem of terror, specifically the religious fear of art, and its converse, the artistic fear of religiosity. The latter may not be as immediately or intuitively as obvious as the former, but I think that in fact it's equally powerful in both ancient and modern times, and again in many different societies. Remember the golden calf. There are, of course, many ways in which these fears, fears of idolatry and fetishism, are and have been historically articulated or sublimated, avoided, or dismissed. But I'd like to begin by focusing on a particular matrix of fears that come from some recent personal experiences. Last year, and sorry for the slide so fuzzy, last year, in connection with a series of lectures I'd been asked to give on art and art history at a couple of Danish universities, I got involved in what had been an ongoing public debate in Denmark and around the world, less so in the U.S. with its racist hate radio and increasingly provincial and corporately managed media, which had been triggered by the controversy over the publication in 2005 by the Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten of a series of cartoons, some of which caricatured the Muslim prophet Muhammad. Jyllands-Posten was long famous for its political satire and social caricatures, which were generally unremarkable in the context of Danish attitudes toward freedom of expression, which are considerably more open, as they are more generally in Europe, than what's become common in our country in the past half decade or so. Jyllands-Posten was and still is well known for its satiric exposure of buffoonery and political and religious pomposities of all sectarian flavors. But in early 2006, a group of ultra-fundamentalist Danish Muslim imams began to circulate copies of these cartoon images of Muhammad around the world as evidence of not simply a racist attitude by Danish newspapers, but of Denmark itself, of the entire population of all Western non-Muslims in every country in the world. This deliberate inflaming of global opinion led, as you might remember, not only to the boycott of Danish goods, the destruction of Danish, Western, and prominent Christian or Jewish properties around the world, but also to the murder of at least 30 people in several countries east and west. The attitude of the Danish newspaper's editors was to unapologetically dismiss these protests as complete lunacy on the part of people unable to comprehend that freedom of artistic expression was a guaranteed right in Danish society. Basically, what the newspaper expressed, supported overwhelmingly by Danish public opinion, was the reaction that, well, this may be blasphemous in your fundamentalist belief system, but that's your problem. If you want to live here, be a citizen, you should obey the laws, respecting freedom of expression and respecting beliefs other than your own. As you can imagine, this attitude served to accelerate the violence, destruction, and murder even more, and although it was later modified slightly, it was never really recanted. And what these controversies had actually suppressed was the actual historical variety and ambiguity of attitude toward the representation of religious figures, or representation in general, in various Muslim societies, ranging from absolute prohibition of representation in Arabic-speaking part of the Muslim world, so it's the minority part of that world, and especially in ultra-fundamentalist Saudia, or Saudi Arabia, to ambivalence or support in the Persian, Turkish, Urdu, or Slavic-speaking, or Indonesian-speaking areas of the Muslim world. The attitudes of the Hadith, the commentaries on the Quran, have been ambivalently interpreted in various societies at different times, and differently as well by Sunni and Shia sectarian communities. Having worked and lived for several periods of time, over some 2 decades in Egypt, I've become familiar with the complex attitudes toward representation in the history of Islam and Islamic art over the centuries, which mirrored similar debates in other religious communities, especially in Europe, which saw comparable clashes between traditional iconophilia attitudes in the globally dominant Christian sect Roman Catholicism and the fundamentalist iconoclasm and image destruction of early Protestant Christianities. Such divisions in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries led to decades of ongoing internecine warfare within European Christianity, as devastating as the ongoing war between Sunni and Shia sects within Islam today. In Europe, the utter weariness of whole populations of endless internecine warfare over points of theological principles few people came to understand any longer or cared much about was to lead to the historic ceasefire, which came to be known as the Enlightenment, which aimed to create a more sane or secular clearing within the jungle of violence, death, and destruction perpetuated in the name of religion, a clearing which gave rise to the modern world as we more or less know it today. At any rate, in my art history lectures in Denmark, I obliquely referred to the cartoon controversy as one related to a clash over the significance of representation as such, about which there have been ongoing controversies in both East and West for the past 2,500 years at least, both in Near Eastern tribal monotheistic faith systems such as Judaism in that part of ancient Palestine called Israel, or Zoroastrianism in that part of ancient Iran we know as Persia, and in post-tribal or global monotheism such as Christianity and Islam, or even in earlier or contemporary traditions of the ancient Greek alternative to state religion, namely philosophy. My talk in Denmark, entitled Plato's Dilemma, sought to understand the logic behind why it was that religious fundamentalists or literalists of many periods or many faiths feared or indeed quite literally lived in terror of art or artistic expression, not uncommonly to the point of murder. I was interviewed after my lecture. I'll try to spell out the logic of this as I go on. What is it about art that's so fearful? There are similar attitudes toward representation in ancient Judaism as well. I was interviewed after my lecture for an article in the Copenhagen Weekly Journal Information, the publication of which then led to an invitation to return to Copenhagen in January this year, to give the opening address to the international conference organized by the Danish Royal Academy of Art, devoted to the contemporary critique of religion. It was advertised widely under the scare-inducing title Godless Rulos. The conference, as you can imagine, led to a great deal of public controversy and to TV interviews, not with me, thank God, and live debates with conference organizers, and also, except for the conference organizers and participants, to a virtually complete misunderstanding of the arguments in my conference paper. Well, some of this was due to the fact that my paper was delivered in English, and despite the fact that Danes, pardon me, was 95% bilingual in English and Danish, and many, like many Europeans, especially younger ones, speak three languages these days, much of what I was arguing seemed to some observers very counterintuitive. It was the nature of that counterintuitiveness, or rather, my trying to understand what was really being understood intuitively by those who didn't get it. That's part of the book I'm currently working on that Susan mentioned earlier. There's, to be sure, a great deal of controversy and confusion about these issues, and a great deal of acrimony about what is called religion, although the word acrimony is surely an euphemistic avoidance of the facts of life in the contemporary world, where countless individuals, and indeed at times whole populations, are murdered in the name of religion on every continent. In an age witnessing the spread of theocratic demagoguery in many societies, not least our own, and the increasing devastation and death that seem permanently endemic to many forms of state-supported and politically enforced religiosities, perhaps the most pressing civic task facing all of us today is that of effectively diffusing the insanity so sadly being promoted everywhere in the name of religion, but exorcising the terror generated by theocratic religiosities and fundamentalisms requires more than replacing politically instituted religions with kinder, gentler spiritualities. For many of those currently on offer, including some we here in Europe may entertain or may even be promoting ourselves, may also unwittingly, of course, be as pernicious and as dangerous to civil democratic society and its promise as more overtly theocratic fundamentalisms. And so there are pictures on the wall which are related to what I'm speaking about, and to some extent common directly in some extent. This is the ruler of North Korea whose statue is marrying those young couples. This is North Korea, whose statue is marrying, literally marrying. It's a religious society. I think a radically different approach is needed today, one that engages directly with what has engendered and enabled all forms of spiritualism in the first place, one that explicitly addresses the most deeply enduring fears at the heart of faith systems. These are fears that come less from competing religions, faiths, or spiritualisms, and I think much more importantly and more seriously from that which has engendered, enabled, maintained, and perpetuated all religions in the first place, namely art itself. So what exactly is it that is so dangerous about art? So there's several interrelated points I'd like to make in my talk. These are points, or perhaps you want to think of them more formally as theses, which are intended explicitly as provocation for discussion, the first of which is simply this. This is the first one. Every instituted religion is above all an aesthetic practice, or in general practice, in denial of the artifice of its own artistry. Amnesiac, ambivalent, or duplicitous with respect to its foundations and origins is a product and effect of art, with respect to the fabricatedness of its own fabrications, and with respect to the artifice of what is being promoted by every religion as real or natural or as revealed, authored or designed by immaterial forces, spirits, gods, divine persons, entities, or beings. Of course, it should be said right away that the personification of such forces, the articulation of that immaterial spirit as a being, in other words, projecting that spirit as a god being or other parental projection or replacement, is no small part of the problem, especially in the various versions of monotheistic versions of religion. But there are some traditions in both West and East in which that force is not a being at all, including the original Christian tradition, later called Greek Orthodoxy, from which the Western European Roman tradition and all that emerged from, later from that was historically an offshoot. I'll turn to the question of the nature of God later if we have time. I really wanted to say that I'll turn to the question of nature of God later. A question shed right away. In connection with the first piece, this is my favorite slide, it's also in North Korea, the Museum of the Revolution, in which small school children are transformed into great warriors by passing through the museum as they come to the left and come out to the right. What a commonly differentiated in modernity is art and religion, in fact, constitute alternative perspectives on or variant responses to the more fundamental philosophical problem of representation or signification as such. That is exactly how we imagine things to mean, of which what we term religion and art are secondary products and effects. As I said earlier, it's at that more fundamental level that effective and enduring critiques of religion and of art could be developed. I can sense that some of you may wonder why art or entertainment needs to be interrogated or critiqued instead of simply being enjoyed for its beauties or pleasures. After all, what's wrong with living your life in a personal bubble of belief, which is your own business? George Bush believed that his God, his higher authority, as tells us, which we now know is not some Southern Baptist God, but Dick Cheney in drag, tells him what to do to it, which surely doesn't affect anyone else, right? So what I'd like us to consider today is imagining a different kind of relation between what is referred to as art and religion. And so a different sense of relationship itself by investigating what I'd like to call provisionally a kind of differential intricacy between art and religion. Which leads then to a second thesis, which is this, that the involvement of art and religion with each other constitutes their only substantive reality or identity. Art and religion having reality in terms precisely of that articulated relation between how things mean as, if you will, contrasting semiotic possibilities or ideologies. Art and religion are variant responses to or perspectives on a common philosophical problem, namely the nature of signification or representation as such. Both have only circumstantial independent existences as effects of something more fundamental, positions taken on the nature of representation, which of course is not to say that religion and art don't have specific or distinct cultural and social significances. even if the terms themselves, commonly used today, may have no real essence behind them, or essence is so diffuse and slippery, and historically so contingent as to be in effect substantially, substantively, or ontologically meaningless. It is, of course, obvious that both forms of knowledge production or epistemological technologies have considerable influence and power over citizens in many contemporary societies. In the case of some religions, again, a direct and often politically enforced legal power over the life and death of individuals or whole populations. As in the case of aesthetics or artistic vision, longing in some cases to become everyday politics, legally enforced, effectively in the case of Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin, or less realized in the case of Ayn Rand, the Reverend Moon, Deepak Chopra, or Martha Stewart. What might be claimed that not so many have been murdered for explicitly aesthetic reasons, except in old Hollywood movies, where Native Americans being ethnically cleansed are always cast as somehow especially unattractive. Nonetheless, artists as fundamentally dangerous and life-threatening as religion continues to be, even if both may at times have had some well-documented redeeming qualities. So what exactly is at stake here in raising such difficult questions today? For one thing, these ancient questions continue to underline and define much of what we believe and do in the contemporary world. Much of what has passed for critical commentary on the recent politically motivated and media-driven phenomenon of what began to be called about a decade and a half ago in the corporate media, return to or return of religion or spirituality. One of the things that, in fact, led to the invention of Europa as well as of comparable institutions in the 1970s, which by and large often avoided what was more fundamentally at stake, namely the artifice or the artistry of spirituality, or what's spiritual life, and what has conversely been called the divine teleology that underlies the professional intention to and practice of art in the modern world. Art is a kind of secular theology. Any critique of or promotion of religion is necessarily connected to critique or promotion of art, artistry, or artifice, and vice versa. So what I'm trying to say is that what might be at stake in interrogating religion or art today, we need, as I said, to first understand more clearly how art might be seen as dangerous or even deadly. To do so, we need to look beyond the ethnocentric, modern, globalized discourse on art, so-called fine arts, including literature, which were developed as service industries in the formation and early evolution of the modern European nation-state, and look beneath the glass floor of this modernist discourse on art and literature. A decade ago, the philosopher Giorgio Agamben, in his book, The Man Without Content, noted that, quote, Plato and Greek classical antiquity in general had a very different experience of art from the art of art history of modern times. Experience having little to do with disinterest or aesthetic enjoyment. It was the power of art over the soul that seemed to him so great that he thought it could by itself banish and destroy the very foundation of his ideal city. But nonetheless, while he was forced to banish it, he did so reluctantly, since, as he, quoting Plato himself, we ourselves are always very conscious of our magic spell. Art was clearly understood in European antiquity to be among the most powerful, dangerous, and terrifying of human phenomena, evoking divine terror with Theos Phobos. While this may seem incomprehensible today, given what you see on the screen, how we tend to view passively of art, understanding what is at stake for Plato is essential to our understanding what joins and what separates art and religion today. Since in our own modern understanding of art is, by comparison, so safely domesticated politically by the institutions of art history, museology, and aesthetic philosophy, or literary history, theory, and criticism, Plato invoked an already ancient and persistent ambivalence about the uncanniness of art, about its ability to simultaneously fabricate and problematize the political and religious power imagined to materialize or represented in a people's forms or practices. Steve Taylor talked about this in his talk yesterday, as you know. And by this, I mean the ambiguity of artistry or artifice as such, and not simply reflecting or representing, but also, in fact, in fabricating the actual world in which we really do live, the problem encountered in Book 6 of Plato's text, The Republic. Art, and especially what Plato called the pantomimic or mimetic arts, problematize seemingly secure conventional opposition between what you might commonly designate as fact and fiction, history and poetry, reason and emotion, art and science, all of which art threatens to reveal to be circumstantial and transitory effects of human artistry as social and cultural conventions. what artists were created for Plato then was not some second world along with the everyday world in which we live, the modern fantasy worlds of fine art or shopping. He was clearly quite clear that what artistry created was the very real world in which we really do live our daily lives. The problem he attempted to address was fundamental to philosophy, politics, and religion. If you believe that a particular made thing, an artwork or a poem or a dance, represents, that is, represents or makes present again some essence, either metaphorically contained in some object, or some something absent and elsewhere, for example, things like souls or spirits of a person, tongue, or place, then it's obvious that the essence purportedly represented could also be represented in other ways, problematizing the existence of that essence itself, leading one to imagine that the essence supposedly represented is in fact the product of its so-called representation, its methods of knowledge production, its epistemological technologies. Such an awareness obviously has the potential to radically undermine the claims of any political or religious power to truth and security. As Plato is perfectly aware in his book, The Republic, in his attempt to describe what would constitute an ideal state, it is precisely that conundrum, the paradox of mimesis or representation, what I'm calling Plato's dilemma, that's exactly the problem that's the central conundrum of the practice of theology and art history, or of literary history and criticism. Art is essentially duplicitous, potentially empowers and disempowers. It is therefore not simply entertainment, but potentially also content. Is therefore essentially ethical and political by nature. The godlike terror, that exposure to art induced in the ancient Greek soul, was simply and precisely the terrifying awareness of exactly this, that works of art don't simply imitate some imaginary essence or idea, in fact create or open up a world and keep it in existence, as Heidegger famously put it in discussing the ontological and creative potential of works of art in his essay, The Origin of Work of Art, where he takes the experience of art to be fundamentally religious in nature, or rather more precisely, where, as he made very clear in this text, the common distinction between art and religion was itself problematized and rendered circumstantial rather than ontological. So the basic issue here is that of the truth or falsity of imitation or representation. Is the work of artistic creativity an imitation of some ideal essence, immutable truth, or transcendent reality, the phantasm or ideology systemically built into modernized discourse, practices such as art history or visual culture studies, once probably problematized by what was called postmodernity 25 years ago when it had a certain bite? Or is it mutability itself that is enduringly transcendent? The latter, so well known in Buddhist philosophy, is of course of even greater antiquity in the extant discourse of Western Greek philosophy as well, in which, however, in contrast to many other traditions, was grounded in democratic politics, personal and social accountability and negotiation, rather than in belief and obedience to those claiming truth or wisdom. This is precisely the problem that so directly engaged later monotheistic religious thinkers such as Augustine and Aquinas, all of whom knew exactly what was so dangerously at stake and what they clearly understood as the challenge of art to officially sanction religious faith. What, in other words, is the ontological status of a text or an utterance of an artwork? Are they the effects of a pre-existing spirit, soul, character, or mentality? Or is that spirit or mentality an after effect or product and projection of artifice itself, which is the unsolvable conundrum of all art history, theory, and criticism, of every investigation and interpretation of culture, whether visual, verbal, tactile, olfactory, kinesthetic, and so on. Which then leads to a third thesis, or a third provocation. There is underlying what I've been suggesting so far, a kind of theological dualism, which inhabits the heart of the traditional critique of these problems, which is the claim of a distinction or opposition between what might be called materialism and immaterialism. The rhetorical double bind of matter versus spirit, a distinction, of course, which is a specifically theological hypothesis or claim masquerading as a philosophical or ontological first principle. With respect to art, both Heidegger and Agamben argued that in the modern age we're cut off from the dangerous powers of art because our relationship to it, although this little girl here at the Metropolitan Museum understands exactly what's going on, and in a curious way secularized by the pseudosciences of aesthetic philosophy, art history, or museology. Artworks have been domesticated into serving as mere reflections or exemplifications, representations of hypothesized certain historical processes or identitarian politics, as artifacts of individual or collective values or mentalities, or as objects for aesthetic consumption, entertainment, and the judgments of individual tastes, as commodified exemplars of value, mentality, or artistic genius, or personal or collective style. Artworks today elicit oddly passive reading, appreciation, admiration, explanation, and interpretation, rather than active or passive engagement. Instead of passionate engagement with art, we have the absurdities of art criticism or literary criticism, whose very language is a thinly veiled or secularized version of ethical judgment. That's my, how my voice, by the way, it sounds to me kind of odd. All right, okay. It's odd anyway. The art object is reduced to being an historical aesthetic puzzle, eliciting cleverly articulated solutions, the magisterial pronouncements of the sanctioned critic, historian, museum curator, gallery owner, or collector. But such an ideology of representation is in fact a kind of secular theology, a point which I'll turn to in a moment. Let's turn to Plato for a moment. We need to understand very clearly what exactly was at stake in this call to banish the arts, that enduring puzzle haunting every subsequent Western art theory. He was writing about what constituted an ideal city and social order in the face of the very dangerous powers of art to both create and problematize manifestations of political power. The mimetic arts here should ideally be employed to give proper or appropriate expression to a city and social structures. Its hierarchies of individuals and groups must be clearly mapped onto and into civic space and time. The distribution of citizens and their livelihoods, classes, and maps of representation of the ideal of truth of the city itself. Everybody and everything should know its place and overall scheme of things. A world in which what is materially fabricated evokes and signifies true order, believed by those holding desiring power, of course, to constitute that world or cosmos, in which, moreover, and this is crucial, is imagined to have an existence prior to and independent of its expression or materialization. As if the material world were a simulation of some pre-existing or divinely given essence or truth or natural law, which is why Plato set an infallible philosopher king as ruler of his ideal city, a legal representative and enforcer of a divine order, a decider, see, using contemporary Bushism, whose god speaks to him and tells him how to vote on the minimum wage or how to abolish habeas corpus or how to cut even more taxes for the grotesquely rich. Product and artifact, in fact, linguistic syntax, which has deadly implications for whole populations. But any piece of artifice is a witness both to what it may be taken to represent and its opposite, as well as witnessing the arbitrariness of claims of representative truth. He turns to arbitrariness of representation as such, which is the fundamental problem of all religion, on which the very possibility or cogency of any religion is made possible in the first place. What is customarily called religion is an epistemological technology concerned with assigning value to a set of phenomena or characteristics that are claimed by those claiming the use of power to have already existed in the world. It consists of the postulation by legal enforcement of a social and philosophical decorum, whereby material phenomena are linked as if they really represented their allegedly pre-existing ideas, values, mentalities, truth, or essences. As if what I wore or how I enjoyed my food or garden or sexuality or what kind of hybrid car I don't really drive is a representation of my truth of somehow who I am. We don't need to expand too much on the brutal absurdities of contemporary identity politics or fashion, which are manifestations and effects of this secular or not so secular religiosity. But such fantasies are precisely what you're programmed into believing by corporate capitalism and corporatized religion. You are your stuff, or what your stuff can be read by yourselves and by others, but who and what you really are, so that even more and better stuff, or its spiritual equivalent, good works, can signify that your life can be made better and better in every way. In other words, the essential secret of religion is that there really is no secret at all that is separate from its expression. Being is not distinct, except nominally or verbally from interpretation, which is to say not distinct from artifice. The point is to repeat the first thesis that religion is a mode of behavior or artistry which is in denial of or consciously duplicitous regarding the fabricatedness of its own inventions, commonly attributing that artifice to the design of an imperial or sectarian leader than allegedly pre-existing or originally being or forced. So what should then begin to explain the logic of certain religious strictures against representation, whether the representational image of a prophet, as in fundamentalist Islam, the complete spelling out of the Jewish name of its own spirit being, or a picture of what one might imagine one's own sacred spirit to be. Of the three major monotheisms, it was chiefly Christianity, which came to tackle the problem of representation directly by engaging with the religious import of imagery itself, in no small measure, because it's own early growth within an evolutionary relationship to the more ancient iconophilia parts of the cultures of Egypt, Greece, and Rome. Plato, and in this he was followed by the literalist branches of all later monotheisms, would have banished the arts from his ideal city state because their potentially destabilizing influence on the imaginations of its citizens, causing them to literally think otherwise than what they were legally compelled to believe. The problem again is simply this. If the state, if your community, if your nation is recognized for what it is, namely a fabrication, a human artifact, then other kinds of states, other modes of civic life, or even other modes of being human, might be imagined and given form, calling into question the naturalness of the state one has. Plato, who is no democrat, was very clear that when it comes to the arts, everything, including our identities and our very existence as social beings, is radically and fundamentally at stake. Some about Augustine, Muhammad, the iconoclasts of Byzantium, or early radical Protestantism, fully appreciated and attempted to legally enforce, often under pain of death. So the acknowledgement of the existence of art as artifice is one of the foundations of the philosophy itself, as the aim to bring antidote and alternative to religion, as critique and discernment, a dialectical and dialogical questioning of the naturalness of nature, as what someone once said, incessant vigilance about how and why and what we are meant to tend to take for granted. Or to put it in terms familiar with Naropa, what is so precisely and called mindfulness, with all that, that entails. For philosophy, hypotheses are points of departure and of inquiry, of contention and negotiation, in contrast to socially, legally, and politically instituted religion, where such hypotheses are on the contrary promoted and fabricated as first principles, as if they were ontological truths demanding obedience. I'm trying to make this even more explicit. For Plato and for Augustine half a millennium later, politics to be effective or sustainable and lasting would have to be, or seem to be, effectively grounded in permanent truths that were to be believed by the ordinary citizen, of course, not the aristocracy, to be above and beyond the mutable world of daily life. Plato's dilemma, in other words, was thus a very powerfully real one. How do you instill a securely unquestioned belief in one's city or state or nation or culture or ethnicity or identity, and also not supernaturally in one's rulers and lords, that is amnesiac with regard to its fabricatedness? How do you design amnesia? Something that reached the bachelor's and fantasists of intelligent design that very carefully and assiduously avoided addressing. It's all of their rhetoric is designed precisely to make people forget about the fundamental contradiction in the phrase itself. Or think of all those Wall Street gangsters desperately bleating on to all of us that closing plants and outsourcing jobs is simply the natural law of the free market. For the past two centuries, what we commonly refer to as art has served as a site par excellence for the production of the fictions that brilliantly woven together make up the fabric of all our modernities and postmodernities. The phantasms of identity, ethnicity, class, race, gender, nation, sex, indigeneity, and otherness, which you're induced to imagine as represented or expressed in the products and effects of individuals, groups, ethnicities, genders, nationalities, races, languages, and so forth. That smartly postmodern printed symbol on the wall behind me here, magically encapsulating the very spirit of Naropa, why and how is that made believable? And what relation does it bear to the one in the upper left wall over here on your left? How do you render the some handcrafted wooden thing on the left? How do you render a signal of the punitive contrast between university and institute? Will the real Naropa please stand up already? The key metaphorical conundrum of our post-enlightenment modernity is replicated as endlessly in the fancy world, not only of every shopping mall, everywhere around the humanly fabricated world, is, as I said earlier, that the form of your work, the production, behavior, should be legible as the figure or physiognomy of your truth, a symbol, sign, or echo of who and what you really, really are. Now, it shouldn't take much reflection to appreciate that this is a modern secularization of earlier modes of Christian religious piety and of the care of the soul, where the state of one's soul should ideally be manifested or represented by one's deeds or good works. You are your stuff, again, is the corporatist inflection of the religious belief that you are as good or as bad as your good or bad deeds. This amalgam of ethics and aesthetics, manufactured by the industries of visual representation and spectacle, what corporate capitalism has entailed and afforded, every object always ultimately staged as an object lesson, and a lesson order with exchange value in a commodity marketplace. to repeat what I've rephrased what I said earlier, you are what your lifestyle appears to say about who and what you are, which indents the core fantasy of capitalist modernity and corporatized religion. More and better stuff can speak more and more truly of your continually evolving selfhood, your real essence. Some of the more bizarre religious sects today, or in the codified practice of legally sanctioned public gambling, we call the stock market, being rich is simply a sign that God or nature approves what you do. And many, many people really, 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 really believe this. It's not difficult to appreciate that all of this really is a secularized theology. As E. Karl Marx put it, made quite explicitly clear when he referred to the modern commodity, the keystone of modern capitalism, as fundamentally theological in nature, which was precisely the central point of his exhaustive critical analysis of capitalism, which, as Walter Benjamin once put it, smothered 19th century Europe like a fog, obscuring the earlier organic and complex relations between people and things, making of those relationships immaterial fetishes. To shop is to work on the artistry of one's personhood, so that it would appear to reflect or represent one's inwardness, one's inner character or spirit. We all know that shop at Whole Foods in Boulder, or as we in Boulder say, a whole paycheck, you're a decent person, especially if you also drive an Audi or a Benz or a Prius. Maintenance of this matter spirit division requires certain predestined decorum, and some legally designated appropriateness or natural order of things. In this way, the ideal city or state would conform its social system ordering its collaborating classes, races, or genders to mapping alleged by those in power, be literally imposed by nature or the natural forces of the free market or human nature, or by the command imputed to some abstraction such as the parental projection of God or spirit being. All sovereignty fundamentally depends on its enabling condition, its convincing artistry, its ability as theater or spectacle to convince and compel belief and obedience. And isn't Mitt Romney really gorgeous? So I'd like to begin to tie up all this, I think in my case, maybe a more question of lassoing cats than cows, by summarizing some of my main points. By the way, I should say, in the handout, there are two extra pages which are an appendix, which you can read later, so I'm not going to go through the entire thing. All religions, historically, have been fundamentally invested in the problematic of representation, and that each constitutes a relative position or set of positions taken with respect to the rhetoric, syntax, or semiology of signification, nature of the relations between an object or event and its assumed cause, the nature of what it means to witness. All religions, in other words, are more or less formalized symbolic positions and formally enforced perspectives taken with respect to the nature of the sign. In the case of many, if not most, of the currently surviving and politically promoted religions, this entailed the declaration of often commonly masked ontological dualism, the hypothetical opposition between what I call materiality and immateriality or spirituality. But this positing of a dualistic ontology, whereby a material world is contrasted with an immaterial or spiritual and transcendent world, is not, however, except in the case of true Manichaean dualism, an opposition between two equal states, but is rather marked by a hierarchy of value, where in one realm, the spiritual or immaterial, is normally posited or hypothesized as transcendent and primary, wherein is the origin or cause of the world of the material. The material world is the product and effect of transcendent immaterial forces. Such dualism is, of course, not neutral, but is already articulated from the perspective of religious faith systems themselves, a function or fiction of religionist rhetorical categories. It's commonly the realm of the immaterial. The big other is personified or reified as the material force or being. So it's precisely on this point that the two principal global monotheisms, Islam and Christianity, most commonly contrasted, although they both share a common fiction that a properly indoctrinated or invested believer can, under certain prescribed circumstances, stand in for or represent the immaterial other as it's engendered as his voice, promoting or enforcing his will. Famous and powerful proofs of the existence of God, for example, the work of the famous medieval Christian theologian Thomas Aquinas, are effectively convincing only if you believe in the first place, have faith already. Simply by evoking the materiality of the world, that the world is characterized by a property of gross materiality or the palpable or concrete, it at the same time co-produces its supposed antitheses, the spiritual or non-pre-or-post-reactor material world. Albert suggests a further conclusion, namely that the maintenance of this dualism generates an uncannily oscillating ontology whereby materialism and spiritualism, to use the common terms, are always fantasized as perpetually struggling in a cosmic Hollywood or Bollywood battle movie for a possession of primacy or transcendence, neither ever permanently secure Battlestar Galactica really never will end. In other words, the belief in a realm of spirit or immateriality and its lower or derivative antithesis, the world of pure or mere matter, allows for the possibility of each perspective imagining and, of course, fearing its antithesis. Each is the ghost which are perpetually haunting the body of the other, the system of its otherness. Let a ghost of young, boyish flesh haunting the minds of those homophobic ministers in the pulpits of Boulder's evil twin sister city, Colorado Springs, to the south of Denver. Each realm or mode of being is essentially unstable or fragile, as its essence always contains its opposite, each opposite, each elsewhere, being what grounds and makes possible the first realm in the first place. They will always flip flop. So the extraordinary fear, the terror endemic to all, and especially monotheistic religions, in the face of possible disobedience, is really, in fact, a perfectly logical and consistent application of a systemic need to forestall or prevent even the imagining of difference. The degeneration of Plato's worst nightmare, as you know, which he clearly railed against 2,500 years ago before Kerouac, Waldman, and company. As I noted earlier, this was of a certain social, political, and economic system where an artifact of human artistry is subject to democratic discussion and debate. So, this again is perhaps another paper, perhaps unrelated. Both Plato and Augustine were being perfectly consistent in articulating an equation between religion and politics. Ideally, for both, there would have to be a non-distinction or fusion between politics and religion, a situation echoed today in the violent movement by anti-democratic and counter-revolutionary fundamentalists in the U.S. to literally erase the separation of church and state and establish theocracy, especially a Christian one or a Christian Zionist one. We really are at war, though which Iraq is a sideshow. Or in a parallel but equally fundamentalist political movement to encourage, promote, and market certain New Age spiritualisms so as precisely to deflect and privatize, however unwittingly, political or civic engagement by promoting personal bubble mentalities and civic disengagement. Do your stuff. One of the things I was initially hopeful about the founding of the Europa Institute was its commitment to civic engagement and the critique of hegemonic power, which one devoutly hopes is not weakened in Europa's problematic and ongoing reinvention and managerial redesign as a quasi-corporatist university. I totally believe in provocative. Well, again, this is perhaps another paper, but perhaps not unrelated. I seem to be generating more and more other papers here, and so since I suspect you've probably heard enough to get the main points I'm trying to make across, I suggest that time to get to the more important work of discussing all of this. Before we stop, and start again, I mentioned about the appendix before. What you've been hearing were a series of openings, a very long, ongoing critique, a very tentative one, of some very ancient questions that antedate both what we call or and religion today, problems and conundrums that remain unresolved in many contemporary obsessions and debates in our ordinary history and theology. In this one measure, because of the systemic unwillingness of ourselves to explicitly engage the implications of the ethics of our practice. So enough for today. Too much is at stake today to continue business as usual, to continue riding around a cultural carousel of perennial holds out the hope of another brass ring, which if firmly grasped will deliver one more new method to deliver up the illusion that the carousel is not going around in circles. But continue bemusedly drifting the endless enchanted corners of wishfulness. The point of critique is to change the world, not reupholster. And the only way to forward, as always, is to be mindful and to continue to think otherwise. Thank you. Sorry for the voice, but it's on its way. It's somewhere over Iceland.
We don't have very much time for a discussion, and I anticipate a lot of questions. Donald, I'm wondering if it's okay. We take one or two questions here, and then would you be willing to maybe move to Sigmar 8120 or another room to entertain a longer discussion?
Yes.
Okay. So we'll go until 4:30 here, and then Donald can meet you going.
Yeah.
8120 for a longer, more involved discussion.
Thank you, Donald. My name is H.R. Hagenauer, and I'm curious about the question you raised, how do you design amnesia? And I'm wondering if this question is somewhat contingent on, is this state of amnesia one that is wanted or one that is enforced? Or is that an irrelevant difference?
That's a good question. What do you think? It has to be both in some sense, under certain circumstances. And why is amnesia so delightfully desirable? What does it do, or what's at stake in being amnesiac? Where does it allow you to forget, to clear out of your mind so you can focus on something else? So think of amnesia as a strategy, a relational strategy, of relating yourself to a certain common task or a situation. And under what conditions is there a survival value in being amnesiac? But I think there is, of course, a certain amnesia that we have politically and socially in this country, of course, specifically, which is a kind of incrementalness, which I think there's a wonderful quote from Samuel Johnson, who said, "Reason by degrees submits to absurdity as the eye is in time accommodated to darkness." So that's a kind of form of amnesia, creeping amnesia, crepuscular amnesia about society and things that we're being dumbed down to ignore in this country. I'm sorry, this being sound like a sermon. I didn't mean to be.
Thank you.
Hello, my name's Troy. I have a comment, question, and a challenge, I think. 1 minute. Thank you so much for the information that you provided with us and the amount of research you've done and for being here. My challenge to you is, what are you going to do with this information besides lecture? And also, I feel like you've accurately stated the state of things. You've actually given a name to the displacement. You've told us our place in this displacement. And I feel that in order to truly understand this information, we have to act from it. We have to act with this. This is knowledge. To just simply continue lecturing about knowledge without doing anything, you've museumified it. So I'm wondering, what can we do? The imagination says things like continuing breathing, continuing to do your art, continuing to go back to where you're from and participate in some kind of form of activism. But I want some kind of cohesion that might not be accessible.
There was a wonderful comment in the translation panel today by the first speaker who talked about trying to deflect becoming oneself, becoming an object. And I think in one sense that's the key to this problem. One has to keep moving. That living is movement, change, and continually challenging yourself. And so if one can reduce change, one's sense of oneself from being an object with a fixed center and fixed in place, and see ourselves as migrants, which we always are, as migratory creatures, that may be more effective in terms of being effective politically. By seeing that language and so forth, there's always a trap. Art is always a trap. Religion is always a trap. And to always think otherwise, you know, to find some ways that are meaningful to yourself and for yourself as a person in civic society to influence others. Because everything we do affects others. Everything we do publicly is politically, ethically, and destined. So it means that we're always constantly swimming against the folds of the complexities of our own selves. And to be in touch with those, the folds of within oneself, which are continually shifting and changing, being shuffled, gives you a better sense of, I think, being able to contend with the challenges that come from the outside. I'm sorry, that sounds maybe too abstract, but...
It's not that abstract, but it makes sense that that's how you'd answer it, because it is a very specific process. It is about finding meaning within our lives, and meaning seems to be the antithesis to this sort of neoliberalism that we have become sort of isolated inside of.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is the religious lesson about idolatry and why the golden calf was so meaningful, because it freeze framed life or meaning. It made possible to imagine that somehow there was a fixed meaning of everything, so instead of being contingent, negotiable, and being problematized.
Thank you.
Thank you, Donald. Marissa Carell. If one were to acknowledge the dependence that we have on illusion that we're creating through these fixed systems of meaning, how can we... This is our way of relating to what we can't see, and a way of defining ourselves inside of an acknowledgement that there is really no fixed way of inhabiting anything. I just wanted to say, like, something that is not present in your lecture, though you speak to it in a roundabout way somehow, is the interplay of these two very strong institutions. But then there's maybe the realness of ritual, and wherever that's found.
Realness of what?
Of ritual, and wherever that's found, that people need a place, humans need a place to be able to, a system, say, a strategy, to be able to go into a place that is unchartable and unknown. And as artists, that's what we're constantly trying to negotiate.
So,
could you talk about that?
One of the things I was trying to get across that would be interesting to think about is that there is no illusion, because there's only illusion. There's only artifice. There's only fabrication. There's only what we perceive and how we interact with our environment, with the biosphere, with the planet, and how in our actual negotiations with that we create worlds. And so that itself is ritual and ceremony. And because in order for it to be palpable and understandable and be self-reflective, you have to sort of codify it to a certain extent, even if the code is temporary or transitory. And so all ritual has a function of value, but it's not necessarily a fixed or immutable value, a value which is constantly changing and constantly referring. So if you think of these things in relational terms rather than sort of as objects, as fetishes, or idolatrous way, it becomes, I think, more doable and more manageable, where ritual becomes important, but ritual is part of living. So ritual is the ritual of living. So. But actually, this image, this very famous painting by Rousseau, it's in the Metropolitan Museum in Europe, and the one there is the ritual model of the young girl 50 years earlier that she posed for yourself.
Hey, Donald. A question, but before that, I wanted to announce again that after this, we're going to be moving over to 8120 in Sycamore, and also that at in Shambhala Hall after this, that Tisa Bryan's having a crow's chat.
What?
I'm sorry?
At now, 4:30?
No. What time is the first one?
4:45.
So my question is about page 4, the second to the last paragraph, where you mention in relationship to Heidegger that works of art don't simply imitate some imaginary essence or idea, rather they create and open up a world. And since I know you're not a believer in the concept of essence, as I guess
I'm saying that.
I'm sorry?
I said believe in it, but I'm trying to characterize how it works with this mechanism.
I see. We talked a little bit about Spinoza's univocity, that there's nothing outside of the material world. And I guess I'm wondering where that world is that is opened up to. Where is that world? What's something's being opened up to what? Does that make sense?
Why do you see it in spatial terms?
Because you refer to the big other later, which is a Lacanian term. I'm thinking in Lacanian terminology about what is real. And so I think this is a question about what is real. Is it something that we can know, or is it something we can only know in reference, like semiotics?
So what does the idea of the real do for you? What does having a real do? What function does it serve? How's it work?
In your estimation, can we know the real?
If everything felt, if there's no illusion because it's all illusion, then of course it's all real. So.
Very Buddhist.
Of course.
So, if it's all real, then what we do believe about objects that reflect us is also real.
Yes, of course. So then, what do you do with that real? How do you use it? Is it a weapon? Is it a schnuller? A cup? Schnuller? No, sorry. Pacifier. What big is that?
That was all. So let's thank Donald and move over to the